Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I am Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Bob Deutsche, global top technology expert and executive. Bob, you have this amazing background. You've done a lot with many, many corporations, and you've made many, many contributions. Thank you for coming in today and sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
Oh, Stephen, thank you very much for the opportunity. I like to say that I've done a lot of things in my life, so master of none, and but a whole lot of information to share with you, I hope.
I don't know, Bob, when I listen to your colleagues, they say you're sort of the ultimate guru on the global stage.
I think that the caveat is I probably look at things differently. If you look at my background, I'm one of those folks who have had one foot in different worlds. I started off in a line of business IT organization many years ago. And of course, as you know, line of business IT is very different than enterprise. And you tend to focus first on the mission of the business, right? And then second on technology. And then I kind of morphed into enterprise and I've had my own business. So I look at things very differently. I'm a geek, but everybody loves the toys, but I also understand that unless those toys can benefit the company that they're working for, then there's no value. So that's probably the best way to describe my background.
Bob, we're going to start really drilling down now with some questions. So what is the state of enterprise security spend, and why should this change?
That's a really interesting question, Stephen, and the easiest way to respond is today, enterprise security spend is reactive. And in fact, it's whack-a-mole. If you're familiar at all with those arcade games where these things pop up and you're supposed to whack them as fast as you can to get them back down to the hole. And what started me down this whole path, and I profess to tell people that I'm absolutely not a security expert. I look at this from an analytical perspective, as somebody who's a systems engineer. And what you find is that historically, security spend has been a reaction to a breach, meaning that if you get breached in either your end user devices, be it whatever they be, right, or your data center, what generally happens is that you throw money at it to close the breach very quickly, and then if the breach is severe enough, fire the CISO or the CIO, or in fact, if it's really bad, the CEO, right, which has happened in some instances, and then you move on to repeat. And the problem is that that's not sustainable as you move outside your firewalls. And let me just talk about a few points of fact, right, that have driven me to this conclusion. One of the things that there's any number of organizations, Verizon, Ponyman, Gartner, that every year publish different reports on what companies are spending on security investment, right? And what was very interesting, what got me started down this whole path, is that consistently what these companies have been reporting is that for about the last 3 to 4 years, security spend has been flat, right, as a percentage of your IT budget. Now, although they did vary in percentages, right, they were consistent in the way that they depicted how flat the spend was, you know, and in real dollars, okay, given that most IT budgets were going down, okay, that really meant that in real dollars they were spending less, which was really odd because when you looked at companies that sold security software, they were having banner years, right? So it's like, what's going on, okay? So that really was the premise for this whole study that I did. And what I then next did was, okay, I sat down and talked with Intel CISO, Malcolm Harcum, and started asking him about this. And through the course of those discussions, we kind of started exploring what different executive elements in the company think about security spend, right? And where that led to other discussions with other CISOs. And what you found out very quickly a typical CEO looks at security investments as no more, no less than insurance. And, you know, what, you know, if you're like me, right, I like to draw analogies, so please bear with me. You know, you and I are great drivers, right? And because we're great drivers, we probably go with very high deductibles, right? And never anticipating that, you know, the next time we take the car out, we're going to get rear-ended by some idiot, right, who forgot to stop. Well, that's kind of what you see with CEOs. They invest the least amount of money that they possibly can, right? Because, of course, it can't happen to them. Okay, then you look at your typical CFO, and this is a really interesting discussion here, in that CFOs are generally used to technology investment, and that be hardware, software, right, is following a bell curve, and meaning that as you ramp up a particular application or piece of hardware, you know, the costs are initially high, and then, of course, as the maturity of that system starts, you know, happening over a course of a year or two, costs start dropping. Well, that's absolutely not the way with security investment, right? Because it literally never goes down. So by its nature, right, CFOs do not like to invest in security because they don't follow the bell curve. And what has been very interesting there is I've talked with different CISOs across the country. When I asked the specific question about the CFO, I've had a number of them tell me if the CFO ever knew how much money we were really spending on security, he'd shut me down. What a sad statement, right? And I'm not talking, little companies. I'm talking in the U.S., right, Fortune 100 companies where I've had their CISOs tell me this. And so then you get to the CISO. And remember, he or she is the one who has the most to lose if they have a really bad day in breach. And so they look at it, obviously, as this is going to make or break my career with this company, right? And what I loved here is that you know what CISO stands for, right? Career is soon over, okay? And the fascinating thing is that in a typical company, none of this executive group agrees with each other on what security is. And then the problem with that, right, is that unless it starts getting viewed as a strategic investment, right, then you're never going to get any better than this whack-a-mole approach. And what's interesting to me, and I've never been able to prove it yet, right, is that the bad guys seem to be a whole lot smarter about this than, a typical enterprise, right? And if Bob has figured this out, right, then I would suspect that the bad guys have figured it out too. So, you know, obviously what I'm insinuating is that, let's say in year X, there has been a very concerted effort to break into companies via one avenue, right? And recognizing that, you know, what I'm saying is true, that companies will throw a lot of money into that area. Well, if I were a bad guy, what I would be doing soon thereafter, if not the same time, trying to make inroads into an area that I probably know is less defended because of the way companies spend. And so where I'm going with this, and what I call it at Intel, is security by design, okay? Because this cannot be sustained as companies move into the cloud, because to be quite honest with you, they don't have enough money. The first step, obviously, is to have meetings with your various C-levels, start trying to get them to understand that security investment should not be viewed any differently than anything else, okay? Once that's done, you need to then take a look at your overall strategy. What's amazing to me, when you go in to a typical company and you say, okay, tell me what your security strategy is, right, from soup to nuts, most companies can't really give you anything, okay, which probably is not a good idea. So again, it's for people to be able to move to the cloud, right, and for people to be able to integrate outside of their firewalls with other applications with other companies, this absolutely has to change.
You know, it was a fascinating sort of discussion, and because of the sort of the extensive experience you have, and you're getting all of these insights from senior executives, so it's a very, very valuable to our audience. Now, in our next question, I'm going to ask you about the days of the large central IT organization. Are they numbered, or why are they numbered?
Yeah, the answer to this one is not making me the most popular person in the world, Stephen, in that... again, I've been doing this for about 30 years, right? And when I first got into technology, as I said earlier in the call, I was a line of business IT shop, okay? Meaning that we had our own data centers, we had our own applications, you know, everything from the operators in the data centers to the programmers to the analysts all belonged to the line of business. For very good reasons, that pendulum started swinging back to something more centralized, you know, what ultimately evolved into enterprise IT. And as I said, it made very good sense because of economies. But what's been fascinating in those 30 years and is that, and again, this is one of these things, I wish I were wrong. How many, if you were to walk into a typical organization today, right, and try and find the love in the business units for the central IT organization, I'm betting you'd have a very hard time finding that love, okay? Because one of the things that's been absolutely consistent as the move to these centralized business models, centralized IT business models happen, is that everybody loves to hate IT, okay? Now, whether that's deserved or not, you know, I'm not here to discuss other than it's an absolute. What the cloud has done, and again, it's fascinating to watch the business model on this, is that the cloud service providers, the ones who have the data centers, you know, to offer data centers service, more often than not are not approaching the IT folks, the central IT folks. They're approaching the business units first. And, you know, having relatively good success in drawing elements of what had been IT, central IT workload off to these cloud service providers. I think, and again, the reasons that they're having the success, you know, they make a promise that they can reduce costs, excuse me, they make a promise that, you know, the SLAs will be equal, if not better. Now, whether they meet those promises or satisfy those promises, again, it is another question. But I think the operative term here is, you know, why are businesses ready to jump on that, right? And what I think, well, actually, I know we're seeing it, right, is that as more and more of these lines of business get drawn into the cloud, right, with generally without IT's consent, right, then what's going to be left for the centralized IT shop? Well, I think, okay, what we're going to see within maybe 8 years, just it's hard to tell, is that I believe there's always going to be a need for some type of a central IT function, right, that provides core services, okay? You know, what those core services are going to be, you know, who knows? But I don't believe it's going to be anything like what you see today in central IT shops. I think the other thing that's not helped this is that, you know, in general, if you look at where a typical CIO sits today at the table, right? And when I say at the table, it's their status within an organization. Most report into the CFO. There's nothing wrong with that, right? But it kind of goes back to if the CIO, you know, were to disappear, okay, into something less, okay, the central IT core group, would anybody really miss them, okay? And again, this is a very emotional discussion that, you know, obviously because of my background, because of who I generally work with, a lot of people will probably disagree with what I'm saying, right? But we are absolutely seeing this. Now, you know, we're not, again, debating whether a cloud provider can meet their promises that they make, but if the level of dissatisfaction is so high, generally, with today's central IT shops, right, all line of businesses are doing is reacting to that level of distrust.
I guess I can see a lot of churn then amongst people who work in the in the IT shops around the world as they're seeing this kind of movement from this large central IT organization, and it's going to have some impact on jobs, and
it already is, right? I mean, I think that again, I think you see a lot of people in denial, but I'm pretty straightforward with people, right? And what the first question I love to ask when I go into a company is that generally the first place I stop is in IT, right? And I ask them, what do you think your end users is about? What do you think your business partners think of you, right? Then they'll give me an answer. Then I'll go out and I'll talk to two or three of the business units. And guess what? I get a very different answer, okay? And so the point becomes, I think the IT shops that have the central IT shops, right, that have the highest probability of surviving are going to be the ones who are closest to their business. And again, there's no aha to what Bob just said, but I think that the other thing that's been interesting, and again, I challenge, people who listen to this webcast, right, to go out and ask the question, how many CIOs in their organization have been career IT people, rather than people being rotated in from other parts of the business to get the CIO experience, right, and then they move on to something else? I think that's the other thing that people haven't connected the dots yet. It's just how pervasive some of these problems are, is in that if your company is telling you that, rather than bring in a professional, when I say professional IT person, that's perhaps putting a label on something I didn't want to do, but how many people from the bigger business area do they rotate in as their CIO, okay, to learn, and then they move on, okay? What does that tell you about, where they think the talent is? And again, is this right or wrong? I don't know, right? All I know is that, I see it pretty consistently worldwide. And again, it would be very interesting, as people listen to this webcast, right, to see what they think about it. Because, you've got to be a little bit dispassionate about it so that you can view it as, so you can view it from a level where you can perhaps see what is going on versus what you would want to see, what's really going on versus what you wish were going on. I hope that makes sense.
Bob, like you, I've been in this business forever. I mean, I started playing with computers back in the 60s, in fact, built one back in the 60s, and, I've seen a lot of change, and I've seen this sort of computing become from a very sort of technology-centric, geek-oriented kind of professional to somebody who's really wearing a business hat. What are your feelings then about enterprise architecture? I've been hearing about aligning IT with business or really being perfectly supportive of business, and enterprise architecture is becoming, I guess, more and more important. Do you see that role, the enterprise architect, expanding in some way, or do you see that reporting separately from the CIO or CTO and so on? Do you see that as a separate kind of entity working with the executive suite?
I think that, it's a fascinating question, Stephen, because, sometimes, I'm at my core, right? I've had this discussion on a couple of LinkedIn groups, and that I've got a systems engineering background, right? And this is, I'm going to take a bit of time to answer your question, right? But systems engineering, right, was originally devised for, believe it or not, right, at least through USC, for the Air Force, okay? Because, as you might suspect, the Air Force builds some very big systems. And so when I started down the enterprise architect path, right, I could never figure out why I liked it so much until about 6 months ago I figured, oh, right, because it kind of goes hand in hand, right, with systems engineering. And I had a discussion with a guy about a week and a half ago. You know, he asked me to describe what an enterprise architect is, right? And so, well, the good ones, right, are able to kind of look down, you know, let's say that they're on a ladder looking down at the organization, right? And they've got enough knowledge to recognize that if I make a change here, right, here being, and I use generally the TOGAF, the Open Group Architecture Framework, where they talk about enterprise architecture as four domains, right? Business architecture, data architecture, application architecture, and the technical architecture, right? So that, you know, that architect then, from standing on top of that ladder, is able to look down and recognize that if I tweak something here in the application architecture, any one of those, right, it's going to bulge out someplace else, okay? And hopefully, right, they're smart enough to then make sure that that bulging is somehow mitigated, okay? I think the challenge becomes, and this is one of the, perhaps I call it the biggest challenges of enterprise architects, is that oftentimes when the good ones start talking, right, they're accused of trying to boil the ocean, okay? Because if you consider that most technical people are oriented in what I would call, and this isn't a bad thing, they're stovepiped, right? Meaning that if you start in data center, generally that's where you stay, right? Or if you're a programmer, okay, that's kind of where you, and I say, it's not that you don't grow up and grow out, it's just that is where your first love is focused, right? Where architects, even though perhaps some go deeper in you know, for example, I love, it sounds so geeky, but I love data architecture, right? To me, that is where, you know, company lives or dies. And I love business architecture because there's so few really good business architects out there. So anyway, sometimes the architects are their own worst enemy. I think that to answer your question, because there's something I was just reading here last week, you know, where do EAs, enterprise architects, belong? Do they belong in the CIO group? Well, I have to go back to, you know, remember that discussion we had about the statement I made a little bit earlier. Who has a seat at the table, generally? Well, it's not the CIO, right, generally. So if the architect is doing their job, okay, and seeing these things happen, does the CIO generally have a big enough stick to make the enterprise, okay? And I would have to tell you more often than not, no, okay? So I guess what, in a very long-winded answer to your question, I guess if I have my druthers, I would hope that the chief architect, right, would not so much report to the CIO as perhaps report to the CFO, okay, directly. I don't see them reporting directly to the CEO, but, you know, I could see them reporting to the CFO, okay, because chances are that whatever they would be working on, right, would ultimately impact the bottom line of the company. Does that make sense to you?
It makes perfect sense, but, you know, I can see this subject a big debate. In fact, there's a new organization started, I guess, about 2 years ago now called the Federation of Enterprise Architecture Professional Organizations, or FEPO, and what has happened is all the organizations worldwide who are interested in this whole concept of architecture and the different components of architecture, including enterprise architecture, have come together and said, can we bring some harmony to what's out there? Can we come to a common understanding of what enterprise architecture means? And let's work together to help further the profession, further, you know, the whole sort of science, I guess, of enterprise architecture. And in fact, there's a summit coming up in early May, which will even move this sort of further along to defining what enterprise architecture is and what it means and, you know, what are the roles and what does the role involve of being an enterprise architect within an organization. So all of these sort of thorny questions are going to be answered and discussed, and some results coming out from that. So it'd be interesting to see what happens.
Oh, yeah. Well, what's fascinating, right? I mean, it's one thing to be an enterprise architect within the safety you know, an envelope of an organization, right? When I say the safety of an organization, everything gets turned on its head even more, right? When you start looking at this at a cloud level, right? Because then your boundaries change, okay? And again, it's fascinating because you see, at least what I sense, right, within companies, I think companies are beginning to understand how important enterprise architecture is, right? But, I go again back to what I said a bit ago, but within the IT organization, I think there's a lot of not invented here syndrome, right? Meaning that there's also a large group within an IT shop, right, who's very comfortable, you know, data center is data center. Application is application, right? And business is business. And who are these folks that are coming in, right, and saying, wait a minute, right, we've got to rethink all of this, right? Because at some point, they've got to feel threatened. And again, it's not anything that I've read anything about, but it would make, I mean, organization and people are always organizations and people, right? And they're going to protect their bit of the world, right, as best they can. And again, I think that, you know, getting back to the original question, I really, if I have my druthers, I don't think the EAs belong under the CIO. And whether it's a CFO, I'm not sure. Maybe there needs to be another organization. I can't believe I'm proposing that another whole group be formed in a typical company, but I just don't see the CIO as generally being strong enough, right, in terms of having either a big enough baseball bat or, you know, in a typical company, the juice to get what would be coming out of this, you know, enterprise architects through the company. And I mean, I wish I could say differently, but I just generally don't see that happening in most companies.
We're now going to move into a slightly different direction, and that is, you know, there's this really hot term out there, big data. You know, some people are not sure what that means anymore because it's bandied about so much. So can you tell me your thoughts on big data and what are the problems with big data?
It's interesting in that, remember a few seconds ago I mentioned that one of my first love is data architecture, right? And, you know, big data is not a new thing, right? I mean, in another life, I worked with the NSA and CIA, right? And, you know, what people think about, you know, how does one collect national intelligence? Well, you know, the reality is that, you know, one collects national intelligence by, you know, looking all over the world at various bits of information, right? Then collecting that information and, well, this is one element of how you collect it, right? And then sifting through it and otherwise connecting what most people would never see as connected bits, right? And what did I just describe? Well, duh, that's big data. I think that the challenge, though, and I keep in these various groups that I belong to, what I'm looking for is I want a chief data architect's perspective on big data, right? Because big data is going to sell a lot of software, right? Big data is going to sell a lot of professional services, but fundamentally, what's it about? It's about data, right? And I wrote an article or a blog, excuse me, not too long ago, that went into data center knowledge and then the data stack that, in another life, I took a look at different companies, you know, something very simple, right? Customer data. And what you find, right, in a typical company, there are at least 6 instances in every company of customer data, right? And you would think customer data would naturally play a part of, you know, what would roll up into big data. Well, what was very interesting when I did this study, right? Okay, there were 6 instances of customer data in a typical company, of which, and these are rough estimates, right? 70% were kind of sort of the same information. But then there was 25% that was unique, right, to whoever was the steward of that record, okay? So then the question becomes, gee, okay, so all of a sudden now I have big data. So which one of these customer records do I put out there, right? Because remember I said, all of them are about 75% the same, 25% of each record is unique, okay? So which one of the six records do I put out there? Well, if you're like most companies, and again, I've gone out and I've asked a question, would put all six of them out there, right? What a dumb thing to do, you know, then you got, so not only, you know, you've got an ownership question, okay, but you get back to the stewardship question. So, you know, what have I gained other than I've put all this data outside my firewall, right, which makes it, you know, again, going back to security discussion that we started this call on, is that, you know, the more information I put out there for the bad guys to get, the higher the probability that they're going to get it, okay? And so the fundamental question, I keep going back to big data, is that, you know, it is about the data. And some of the challenges that a lot of companies have never confronted is, you know, even within their firewall, is data ownership and data stewardship. Again, you know, you've worked in companies, right? And the funny question to ask is, okay, you know, who owns this record? Well, nobody steps up until, you know, you say, okay, if nobody owns it, I'm going to give it to such and such. Well, then everybody and their brother stands up and say, well, I own it, okay? Well, again, those challenges, you know, 9.5 out of 10 companies have never confronted that internally. So what makes anybody believe that by putting this information outside, right, in this big, you know, I call it the big data pod in the sky, right, it's going to be any easier, and that the information you're going to be getting from it is going to be any more accurate? I think the other thing that my friend John Morton, who I believe you interviewed not too long ago, says is that, okay, now you got the data out there, what kind of people are you going to be able to find that can put all of this stuff together, right? And again, I go back to, you know, some of the little bit of time I spent with the NSA and then CIA, right? They put their analysts through incredible training, okay, to be able to take these, in theory, right, little bits of information that, you know, you and I would not see any link, any connection to be able to assemble these bits into something that, you know, has meaning. Well, where do you find those kind of people? Okay? Because it's not software that's going to do it for you. You know, and you know, if you can find them, how are you going to train them? And again, the thing that's interesting, by the way, these people, it's not going to be, you know, you bring 10 people in and 8 can do it, right? Because it's a very different way of thinking. And even if you have a training session. So let's say maybe 1 in 10 people, and I'm just making this number up, right? Very smart people. You're going to be able to find that can do this for you, okay? How do you train them? And I think what John says is that is going to be the short pole in the tent on this whole effort, right? Where you get the people and how do you train them that are going to be able to do this? And what's fascinating is that's one of the, you know, things that nobody wants to talk about when you read about big data. I mean, you know, I challenge, you know, when you go out and read all of the you know, the latest and greatest on, oh, this is what the future of big data is, nobody wants to talk about that, right? Or nobody wants to talk about, you know, some of the fallacies in the core data that have never been fixed, okay? That all you're doing is amplifying once you move it into this big data pod in the sky. So does that, I mean, I'd be very interested in see what you're hearing on that, Stephen. I mean, you know, I look at this as a data architect, and again, to me, I look at it very pragmatically. I mean, have you seen in what you've been reading on big data anything similar to what I've been talking about?
Yeah, there's a lot of discussion in this area, and much of it aligning with what you're saying. In the investment area, there's a lot of excitement, of course, because it represents a new opportunity, but It's an old idea, but it also has some new elements to it. So it's interesting where it's going. And I guess this kind of leads to my next question. And you've talked about this a little bit before, and that about cloud. So let's explore that aspect, because big data often is associated with the cloud as well, right? Because of all the enormous amounts of data that's collected on the internet. In fact, it's about 2 zettabytes of data on the internet right now. So So what are the government policy implications of cloud ecosystems?
That's really, again, this is another one of these, you know, I could talk about it the rest of the day, but one of the challenges, okay, for cloud to work, right, it has to be a community of practice. And what becomes really, and community meaning without boundaries, right? And what's interesting is that some of the best work I've been seeing is coming out of universities, okay, on this, right? Because, you know, universities generally don't have global or country boundaries, right? And so there's really, you know, probably six or seven considerations that, you know, when I look at government cloud policy that make for interesting discussions, right? We'll get the easiest one, right? I'm saying with a big grin on my face. Security, right? Security is the easiest of all of these, okay? And, it involves, you know, things like privacy and remembering that privacy in the U.S., okay, means something very different in the European Union, okay? It's data retention, okay? It's data location, okay? Some situations of stable service delivery, social infrastructure, user awareness, you know, and what's interesting, again, remember I said this is the easiest of what you're going to hear me say, right? There's a lot of different standards, right? As you go from the U.S. to Europe to Asia, right? And none apply end to end, okay? So as I add others to this, right? I touched on this privacy. What does privacy mean, right? How do you protect personal information in cross-jurisdictional environments, okay? And again, I think probably the easiest way to, if you're at all familiar with the U.S. Patriot Act, right, and what that talks about privacy versus the EU directive on data protection, you couldn't have two things that are so opposed to the other's view, right? And, you know, today, and again, it's one of those things you really got to dig to find this information, but, you know, this is costing today, this difference of opinion is costing millions of dollars, right? Because they're that far apart. I think the other thing that needs to be raised as a government policy issue with cloud is we call it competition and standards, right? A lot of countries are forming, let's just say, not a lot of countries, but let's just say there's less consortia that are trying to drive standards that are worldwide, right, versus consortia that are more geo-based, right? And what's interesting when you go down this path is that, you know, rapid standardization, be it geo-based, primarily geo-based, right, can decrease compliance success through basically locking out other people, okay? And, again, it's not that there are not groups out there trying to look at this from a global perspective, right? But let's just say because of other things, those global groups perhaps aren't moving as fast enough. I think the other thing that again, it becomes a fascinating discussion in regards to is bandwidth, right, management. If you go to different parts of the country, right, the spectrum, broadband spectrum, cost model, you know, it varies significantly, right? And in fact, there's an ongoing, just as we're talking today, right, there's a proposal that our government is looking at to make free Wi-Fi available, right? High speed, and of course, you've got certain industries that are adamantly opposed to that, right, because of the revenue model that they currently have when things aren't free, okay? And then you have another group who thinks that's the best thing since sliced bread, right? But the reality becomes, okay, you know, how do you balance all of this out, okay? Because bandwidth, you know, there is limited spectrum, okay? And all of us expect today, I mean, it's a very interesting discussion, is that, you know, you're sitting just probably like I am, you know, you have probably movies that come in via your broadband or whatever connection you have to your house. You have your whatever you're doing on your laptops, on your tablet, and of course you all expect that to happen as fast as you can press the button. And of course your neighbor has the same expectations. Well, you know, that, as I said, that varies significantly worldwide, but obviously of a bandwidth management is something that how do you balance it worldwide? Perhaps the most difficult of all these considerations is sovereignty. Okay, and again, there's every country, quite understandably, right, is most worried about its own citizens, you know, and its own rights as a country. And you know what happens, and we're seeing some of this today, right, with what I said a bit earlier about U.S. Patriot Act versus the EU Data Directive. I don't want to say versus, but as compared to the EU Data Directive, multiple jurisdictions have an interest in a single matter, but nobody is stepping up very quickly, right, to agree on any rules governing enforcement, right, because ultimately it flows back to the sovereignty of that particular geography. Probably the last bit is copyright, okay, or IP. And obviously, we've been reading a lot about this lately, in that how do intermediaries deploy filtering functions, right, that comply with that jurisdiction rule of law, right? Meaning that there are obviously different geographies in the world where copyright and IP protection, you know, and how that's enforced varies significantly, okay? What happens if when we're working in the cloud, right? When one of those copyrights are infringed in a specific geography, what's your recourse? Do you build in to your application, okay? And I think we maybe talked about this a little bit ago, right? A geospatial based capability, meaning that if the device that you're using knows it's in location X, right, and because of who knows why, you'll only be able to access certain elements of that application, right? There's significant ramifications to that, right? And so again, like I said, as I started this discussion, everybody thinks security is the most stickiest element of the cloud, but it isn't, right? Compared to some of these others.
In your answer to the question, you talked about differences between the U.S. and Europe. Is there one defining difference that you can sort of quickly talk about?
I think it's a question of privacy. If you look at the Patriot Act, right? And again, I'm certainly no expert on all of this, right? But the Patriot Act basically says if the data is here, I can look at it, right? Meaning the government, which is somewhat, if not in direct contradiction to what the EU Data Directive would allow you to do, right? And there's others, right? I mean, this isn't an exhaustive list, right? But in the last time I really looked at this hard, is that the EU has a Electronic Commerce Directive, they have the Data Protection Directive, right? The U.S. has a Digital Millennium Act, Communications Decency Act, the U.S. Patriot Act, the FCC ruling on net neutrality, and Sarbanes-Oxley, right? Japan and some parts of Asia have something called an APEC Data Privacy Pathfinder Project, right? And again, the thing to remember, as I said earlier, right, is it goes back to this whole sovereignty thing, right? Each of these countries is doing what they think is right for themselves and of course their citizens, and it probably is, right? But there's very little activity, at least that I've seen, that is trying to take this worldwide community, right? And remember, I haven't named all the countries out there, to take this worldwide community and turn it into something where if this whole cloud community will actually work, right, that everybody operates under a clearly defined and accepted set of rules. And that's the thing, I think, of everything to really focus on, right? And that's why I keep telling people, well, security is an issue for cloud, but it isn't the issue, right? Particularly if you're a large multinational company or you want to do business worldwide.
Bob, you've worked for some of the largest organizations in the world, and for example, you're currently at Intel. So you see this sort of marriage of kind of different domains from business to software and hardware. So the question is, where does it all end? Where does business software and hardware begin and end?
I think, you know, as I said, when we talked the last time, one of the things that's been interesting to me is, and again, you look at some of the newest products that we make at Intel, right? Things such as vPro, TXT, Node Manager, anti-theft. And as I said, as you go into multi-core chips, one of the things that we're able to do now, okay, is to embed business, I call it business capability, in the microarchitecture of the silicon, right? And which means that what had been something that had to be relied upon either an external manual process or right some type of software, we now embed the capability or some capabilities right in the silicon. What's been interesting about that journey for us, right, is that it's no longer just you turn it on, you turn it off. There's implications as you buy and implement they're more than just a chip, right? As you implement these capabilities, right, they actually reach out into your ecosystem so that in order to take advantage of them, there has to be changes, right, in the way elements of you run your business, right, to, you know, other things. It's really a collaborative type of an implementation, right? And so I certainly see as we look forward, you know, as we can add more core to our microprocessors, I see this accelerating more, right? Where it's going, I honest to God, I don't have an idea, because there, as I said earlier, there are organizational implications that start getting driven by this. Obviously, when you start influencing the larger ecosystem, it's just like anything, right? It involves change. Change is always difficult. As I said, where ultimately this is going, it's very difficult to predict, because as I said, it's a fundamental shift in the way people look at computing technology.
I guess we get to this sort of controversial area of Kurzweil's singularity, or you know, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am, where you're getting more and more embedded stuff in the silicon, and then where does that end, and where does the human being begin and end? So
yeah, well, I think it's very interesting, because, you know, one of the things that I see happening is that, well, whether it's disruptive technology or, I think what's interesting to me, if you look at, and I'm going to throw this all together, you know, the cloud, right, and big data, and what I just talked about, you know, where these multi-core chips are going, you know, it jumbles up boundaries, right? In other words, ultimately, it all comes back, and this I put my systems engineering hat on, right? Everybody has generally been defined by their organizational boundaries, right? Everybody's got their comfort zone. This is where my company is. This is where I fit in my company. Well, everything we've been talking about, right, the cloud, big data, you know, some of these elements that we just touched upon in the silicon, we're changing that, right? We're changing policies, okay? But the problem is, and this is what I tell people about the cloud, right? The cloud is 25% technology and 75% everything else, right? And it's people and organizations' ability to change that strikes me as being one of the biggest challenges as we move forward, right? It's, you know, today I had a very smart person tell me not too long ago that, you know, if you look at today, right, today's organization, typical organization, it's all about, and then again, as it should be, you know, today is the day when companies are primarily worried about generating revenue, right? And it's not that that hasn't always been, but, you know, today, let's just say the focus is on revenue, okay? When people look at the world that way, change, you know, rapid change is generally not a good thing, right? Because the first question is, well, how is that going to impact my ability to generate revenue? That's a really good question, right? Whether and how far some of this technology and how fast it can move, right? It seems to me it's going to come down to a company's ability to change, right? At some of its what I call some of its core functions. I hope this is making sense, right? Because I'm really going out there. Because as you start putting all this stuff together, right, it makes for great conversation until you bring it down to what I call the people level, right? And then the question becomes, how are we going to do this? Okay, because it's great change, and again, it's only going to accelerate. I mean, I think that as I said a bit ago, this is absolutely happening. You know, whether people can change fast enough, people as represented in companies, right, can change enough. That's the one thing I'm probably most worried about, or I have most concerns about. Let me put it that way.
You have a unique perspective of being in a really, really large corporation, which is known for its R&D and its, you know, decades of leadership. And you've worked with similar organizations in the past. And you've had access to all sorts of disruptive innovation and technology. So because of that extensive background as this global leader in many, many areas, what do you foresee is the truly disruptive technology forces for the next 5 years? And why are these forces your choices?
As I said, I'll go back, you know, I see cloud as being one of the most disruptive only because, I mean, cloud's been around for a while, but what's interesting to me is companies still haven't figured out what it is, right? I mean, other than, you know, you've got the leaders who are out there, and everybody's going to tell you they're in the frickin' cloud, right? And, well, what does that mean? Well, you know, you put what I call the no-brainer stuff out there first, the stuff that if it dies or if it's compromised, that, you know, it doesn't hurt me. But at the end of the day, you know, what cloud is to me is data center. Everything is a service, right? I mean, there was a... Well, making a long story short, cloud is nothing more than an external service provider, right? I mean, at the end of the day, whether it's software as a service, platform as a service, infrastructure as a service, right? There's another one that Microsoft coined the term business process as a service, right? And that, to me, there's no companies that are doing that today that I'm aware of. But how that plays out, right? And remembering that it's not the technology that's holding you back necessarily, right? It's a company's ability to look at the new model, right, and figure out whether it can or it can't reduce costs and then adapt their organization to that. Do I see companies, you know, large companies exclusively migrating to the cloud? Probably not. I mean, there's elements that, you know, Intel will never let out, okay, because it's our, you know, it's critical to our success. I think that, again, none of this is, I think the other disruptive forces, I don't know if I'm comfortable with the term disruptive as much as I am with the term as game changing, okay? I see some of the things we're doing with these multi-core chips, right, that I alluded to earlier, as potentially changing everything, okay? Again, but is it a question of disruption or more of internally and externally game-changing, okay? I would say it's internally, externally game-changing, okay? It's just a question of having the, as I said just a few minutes ago, having the people in the organization be able to adapt, you know, if they see a need, okay, to some of this stuff coming down the road. And what's interesting, though, you know, this is not, it's really not unique in history, right? I just got done reading a book on and again, this, I love history, Stephen, and on the American Railroad, right? The billing of the American Railroad system, right? And it's fast. I'm a rail nut, right? And what was very interesting is that, you know, believe it or not, if you go to the mid-1800s, the railroad, okay, did essentially the same thing. And again, it's a very different compare, but if you look at what's going on right now with some of the technology and some of the capabilities we're talking about, you can draw comparisons to what the U.S. rail network, right, did for the United States. It fundamentally changed, okay, the country, okay, and but the country, you know, could only change so fast. So I see a lot, although it sounds a bit odd, you know, I see a lot of similarities, right, between what happened with the way the American Railroad system was built out, right, in its heydays, right, not necessarily today, right, versus what we see going on right today with some of the technologies and capabilities that we're talking about.
You know, it's interesting. I did an interview last week with a European professor, thought leader. In fact, he forecasted probably a lot of the things that were going to happen in many of the domains of the last 30 years. But he sort of drew this parallel between what's happening now in the Middle Ages, and he's saying we're sort of going back to the Middle Ages.
Again, I love history, right? And, you know, as old-fashioned as this sounds, history generally repeats itself, right? And, you know, if you want to be able to understand how you know, things are going to happen, you just start looking, you know, because bottom line is people and governments generally, you know, are consistent, right, in terms of the way they think, in what they do. You know, again, it sounds odd, but if you look back to the mid-1800s, late 1800s, right, the railroad companies, you know, you can make, or the big rail companies at that time, you can make, I mean, again, it sounds easy, but you can make some incredible analogies between, though, you know, what UP, right, Union Pacific, you know, who were huge, okay, versus some of the large tech companies today. And although very different verticals, right, you can, with probably some, remember, connecting the dots, see similarities, okay? And, you know, but again, it's only because people, governments, and organizations fundamentally don't change, right? Because what motivates them then, okay, still motivates them now. It's just a question of plugging in what, you know, the particular vertical is. And that, yeah, Middle Ages, that's interesting, because one of the things that the smart guy by the name of Ed Popisol, he's a guy that I've been working with for Teng Organization for years, and, you know, he said that, you know, what we're going through today, you know, England went through the same thing about 100 years ago, right? And, you know, how he's able to draw comparisons between what's happening today, right, versus what's happened elsewhere in other countries. And it's just being, you know, having a depth of knowledge deep enough, right, to be able to draw those comparisons.
There's some really truly amazing things happening in the world. For example, in the European Union now, they're allocated over $1 billion to build a brain simulation. You have this game EverQuest, and they have 5 million users, and it's being used to model economic behavior. There's a game called Foldit, which determines a protein's folded to enzymes and is succeeding in like 2 or 3 weeks and solving these sort of problems where microbiologists and supercomputers have failed over you know, many, many years. And many of the gamers are in middle school. Or you have this Coursera, you know, where they're offering free courses, and it all stems from Stanford, where not too long ago they had this artificial intelligence course, and they had 160,000 people enrolled, and they had something like 300 sign up on campus, but this quickly dwindled to under 30 within a few weeks, because before the online platform. And this course was translated into something like over 40 languages using social media. And they had more graduates of this program than, you know, all the years that they've held this course at Stanford. And it's sort of brought to light this concept of MOOCs, massively open online courses. And maybe that's going to be truly a game changer in how education is consumed worldwide. So there's a lot of this stuff going on. But again, you're at the heart at a lot of innovation and a lot of really edge-level technologies. So the next question is, what bleeding-edge technologies are you working with?
Yeah, it's just probably the easiest answer there is that I don't even know what bleeding is anymore. It sounds so silly, but one of the areas that we're looking at is, perhaps custom-build chips, right, for particular applications. Given that there's enough volume, that makes it worth our while, right, in order to build a platform specific to an application, okay, or specific for a need. I don't know if that's bleeding edge anymore. I think that, what I tend to focus on, Stephen, is probably much more, taking what we've got, right, and not just what we've got, excuse me, but, a little bit ahead and seeing how it fits in to what business needs. I think what's going to be interesting for us as this year plays out is, making our products solutions oriented, right? That there probably was a time when you could impress people with we call speeds and feeds, right? Those days are done, I believe. The question always comes back to what does it do to improve my business and how much does it cost? Okay. And I think that's probably where I'm most focused right now, if that makes sense.
Bob, your knowledge spans many domains and many worlds in essence. Because you've done so much and you've had this great success history. So from that background, what do you see as the top challenges facing the world today? And then counter to that, what do you see as the top opportunities facing the world today?
I think we touched upon the challenges, right? I think that the technology, and this is a new problem, is just that the technology is evolving faster than people in the policy can adapt to it. And by the time people in the policy have adapted to it, the technology is on to something else. Again, the perfect analogy I love to make is cloud. Policy right now is probably 10 years, roughly. This is nothing, this is still 8 to 10 years behind where it needs to be. So what's the impact, right, does that slow down new technology? No, but, at the end of the day, what values technology unless you can use it, okay? And, that is what I see as probably the number one challenge. I think the number two challenge is, again, this is probably more personal, than anything else. Today companies, understandably are focused on, revenue, right? But I think the question that I always wonder about is, okay, great, you worry about revenue, but what do you do? What do you build, right? And, what's going to be interesting, and again, this is more personal than anything else, you look at the current state of our economy, okay, and, what do we build? One of the things, I travel a lot, right? And one of these trips, I went to the British Midlands, and that used to be where, they built their cars, or they built there was their auto industry. It was unbelievable. It was like ghost town, right? How do we shift? Do we shift, right? From what I call the worry about revenue to actually building, making something, okay? Because if we don't, then as I said a bit ago, you look to history and it probably is not such a pretty picture, okay? And again, that's more personal than anything else. I think that, in terms of our greatest opportunities, never before in the history of mankind have we had the ability to connect people, you know, potentially as we do today, right? And, you know, this goes back to a number of different topics, you know, whether it be here or Europe or Asia or Africa, the capability is there to connect the world like it's never been done before, okay? And with it, as you alluded to earlier, you know, the once you get connected, okay, there are incredible opportunities. But at the same time, I see this as, again, and this may be because of my generation, the other thing that I fear, right, is that sometimes it's way too easy just to, you know, sit at your you know, whether you're working on a tablet or a desk station, just not to get up and go meet somebody, right? You lose the personal touch or the personal interaction, and that's the flip side of this connectivity, right? And because I see, you know, for different reasons, once you lose that, then you've lost something as an individual, and, you know, nothing can replace, you know, being able to look somebody eye to eye. So again, it's kind of a dual-edged sword with that connectivity. And, you know, again, that might only be something with my generation that, you know, I worry about, but I know that I have two younger sons, 30, you know, Rob's 30, John's 23, and they're, you know, we probably differ in opinion on this, right? But it would be very interesting to your larger audience, right? You know, as I said, the connectivity's got a two-edged sword. It's very easy, you know, just to never leave and without meeting people. And I think that human interaction would be sorely missed.
Bob, over the years, you've had many roles and, as I mentioned earlier, a great success history in those roles. Are there some key lessons that you want to share?
I think, you know, you probably get the gist. I'm a realist. I'm a pragmatist, right? And, you know, the one thing that I always tell, and it's not that I don't, you know, believe that, you know, I call it my perfect example. Remember when services-oriented architecture, you know, what was the big thing, right? And you had vendors coming tell you, here's a box, and open it, install it, and you're going to be SOA, right? Well, you and I both know that probably wasn't true, right? And so you always have to balance your pragmatism with, you know, the excitement. The other thing that I tend to, you know, always keep a sense of humor. You know, I tell people, you know, some people are really wound too tight, Stephen, right? And if you can't laugh at yourself, then, you know, you're sorely, you know, you're missing something. And I think I told you this story the first time we talked, right? In another life, I was in the Air Force, right? And probably the thing that changed my life the most was, you're on a flight line at 3 a.m. in the morning. You don't know, you know, where you're going other than it's probably not going to be a nice place, right? And, you know, you're sitting there thinking, huh, right? What could possibly be more game-changing in your life, right, than sitting on a flight line at 3 a.m. in the morning with the possibility at the end of whatever you're going to be doing that day, somebody's going to be shooting at you with the intent of great bodily harm, right? And after that experience, you know, you tend to lighten up, okay? And so, you know, the point that I try to make out of this is that, you know, there's always going to be something more difficult than what you think you're experiencing now, okay? So, you know, just sit back, listen to what's going on, and, you know, keep a sense of humor, right? Because unless somebody's going to be trying to kill you, okay, it's probably not that bad. So I hope I went somewhere with that one, Stephen, because sometimes I use that analogy here, and it's just, you know, you see the eyes get the size of saucers, and but I hope it works with the audience.
It sort of reminds me of Jobs' famous speech that he gave at a university, and it's all about sort of, you know, almost thinking of everything as your last day, and then it resharpens your decision making and the things you're going to work on. I guess it'll put clarify the priorities in your life.
Oh yeah, well I mean it is because you know certainly nobody wants to be put into a situation as I described a few seconds ago, right? But you know it is, as I said, it's you know I call it you and 450 of your closest friends, right? They're getting ready to go someplace that probably is not too nice, and you know ideally you know a lot of people have not experienced that, but as I said, it certainly changes your attitude about a whole lot of things for the rest of your life.
Now, here's a question that you may find difficult to answer, but is there any one or two areas of controversy in the areas that you work?
That's probably an interesting... There's controversy. I don't know if I'm sure how to answer that. I mean, controversial, you know, has a lot of different meanings to different people, and... you know, as I said, I mean, this question about sovereignty that I mentioned earlier, right? That's a very, it can be controversial, but obviously you try and avoid, that level of detail, right? Because A, I'm, you know, certainly no, diplomat, okay? Other than, you know, you need, when you're working on an international stage, okay, or working with internationally, right, you need to be aware of what topics you can touch on, right, versus what topics you probably should not touch on, okay? And I don't think that's any eye-opening statement other than you always need to be aware of, you know, who you're speaking with and what part of the world that they're in generally. And I mean, anybody that's, you know, has an international audience already knows this, so it's not telling them anything they don't already know.
Bob, we're down to our last three questions that I'm going to ask, and this one is about computing in a kind of professional sense. You know, we have things like accounting, medicine, engineering, law, and so on, and those professions are recognized, they have demonstrated professional development. You have to have ethical conduct. In fact, they have code of ethics. The professional has to take personal responsibility for their work. There is public accountability and the fact that you have to always work in the best public interest as well. There's some degree of quality assurance and recognition of that to mitigate risk. And there's recognized credentials. Now, computing... or some parts of computing, for example, security in the U.S. has some of this now where, you know, the U.S. government is mandating some level of certification if you're going to work in security on some of their projects and so on. But generally, computing, from a broader standpoint, do you think it should be a recognized profession on par with those other ones, with all of those elements?
That's an interesting question because I don't think it would be a bad thing. But I think it would be a pretty heavy lift, okay? And the point, I mean, right now, right? I mean, you can become Elements, a TOGAF certified architect, right? That's one. You have ITIL certification, right? You have CMM certification, at Elements. The thing that and remember what I said when I first started, right? I've had a foot in both business and IT for most of my life. I think the thing that I tell my, I mean, as odd as this sounds, right, I've told my sons, don't go into IT, right, because I in general, you know, you don't seem to get the same level of respect, and it's not that respect is everything, but you go into a typical company, and you start looking at the C-level executives, right, and there's a pecking order, and I will tell you that, at least in my experience, you know, the CIOs are never in the top five or six. Right or wrong, hey, is it important? Not really. Should they be? That's an interesting question, right? Because, as I said earlier, most are viewed as necessary evil. And again, I don't mean to overstate this. And again, this is only based upon my experience. Do I think that's right? Probably not. Do I think that it should change? Yeah. but it's the same discussion we've been having for 30 plus years. And if we haven't fixed it yet, then what's the real problem, okay? So anyway, I hope I'm answering that question. I think it would need to, I'd like it to be done. I just don't think it's going to happen near my lifetime. Because as I said, we've been having these same discussions for 30 plus years. I'm very interested in your thought on this one, because that's a very interesting question.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I spoke at the ITU World Summit on the Information Society in Geneva last year, and then again at the Astana World Economic Forum, where I keynoted. And I also spoke at the ISACA World Congress in June of last year, and then in September I again spoke at the World Computer Congress in Amsterdam. In fact, I'm probably getting some of my dates mixed up, but that was in the fall, so I'm safe there. It's interesting that this is what I'm seeing. For the first time, there was an entire stream at the World Congress in Amsterdam on this concept of professionalism. That's never occurred before. And, of course, the ISACA World Congress is a big part of it, is that professionalism, because 80% or something like that of their members are certified, and they follow all of these elements that we talked about. They have recognized credentials. You know, there's a commitment to quality assurance. There's personal responsibility, public accountability, adherence to code of ethics, demonstrated professional development. They have all of those elements. And again, at the World Summit of the Information Society, I actually spoke on professionalism, and we had a number of countries come up and express interest. So the world has really changed with respect to this topic area. In fact, even this UN-founded International Federation for Information Processing, or IFIP, back in 2007, for the first time, their General Assembly voted to support this idea, which, again, has never occurred before. So there is this movement. I see leaders of countries supporting it. Entire countries are now looking at doing some kind of even regulation. In the software engineering side, for the first time in the spring of this year, 10 states are going to move towards the steps of regulating software engineering and allowing the sitting of the professional exam, which makes you a professional engineer. You know, so you write your early qualifying exam, and then you get some professional experience, and then you write this PE exam. And for the first time, they created this PE exam in the software area. And they're the first sittings of it that are going to occur in the spring. And they sort of this critical mass point was 10 states. Well, 10 states have done it. And once 10 states have done it, that exam is available to all the states and territories.
Really?
In the U.S., yeah. And it's interesting. I sit on the board of this organization called FEPL, the Federation of Enterprise Architecture Professional Organizations. And we had the U.S. Government do a presentation. In fact, there's elements of that government that are affiliates or associated with this organization, and they were indicating that they're moving in this direction, I think 2016, something like that. And, of course, on the security side, if you're going to work on really sensitive security-related projects, you're going to need some kind of security credentialing. So. And then even in the interviews that I've done something like over 1,000 interviews over the past two decades, and the majority of them actually in the last decade. And I remember in 2005, I would ask the question about professionalism, what do you think? And I just would not get any response, good or bad.
Really?
Yeah, maybe 2 out of 100. Whereas now, I would say I get 80 to 90 responses out of 100, and I would say the majority are favorable. They'll make some comment that, yeah, ethical conduct is important, quality assurance is important, all of those elements are important, and, you know, what can we do to move this sort of discussion along, right? So from what became like a, you know, where nothing was happening, all of a sudden it seems all this critical mass building around the world, and in fact the Malaysian government is working towards the early steps of regulation of this entire area, and they're getting support from IFIP, this international federation. They're getting support from something called the SoloCord, which is this program to provide standards in computing education worldwide. So, yeah, a lot of movement. in recent history, and it'll be interesting to see or to track it where it goes. And in fact, in just a few weeks, I'm speaking in this topic area at the WSIS Plus 10 Review Summit in Paris. And there's a sort of a session on professionalism, and I'll talk about what's happening worldwide. For example, the CTO of Toyota came out publicly in an interview and said, hey, I think this is a good thing, right? Or you find some other sort of major sort of executives coming out and saying...
Oh, yeah. No, I think it's a good thing, but I think, again, what's been interesting for me, for a number of reasons, I've been, again, remember I'm pretty pragmatic, right?
Right.
I've been looking at CIO postings, right, on LinkedIn, okay, jobs, and what's been very interesting to me, as opposed to, you know, let's say postings for CFOs or COOs, you know, what they want, you know, what these companies in these all sizes, you know, in CIOs, it's almost, you know, they want somebody who obviously can lead, right, duh, and oh, by the way, you know, and again, these are all different size companies that can code, right, and also, by the way, you know, be able to sing or, you know, kumbaya around the campfire, right, with every level at, you know, within the company, right? And what's been very interesting to me in that I think I like what you're saying, but what I'm seeing, you know, from at least as of today, it is contrary to that, right? Because would they ask a CFO to, go count chickens or go count eggs, right, in a chicken house if the need arises in the middle of a Wyoming winter? I'm just bringing that up as a silly example, right? But so it strikes me that I think it's a good movement, but from what I'm seeing today, right, based on, you know, what companies are looking for, you know, at least right now there seems to be a very wide chasm, right, between what they would want a CIO to do, you know, at a C-level, right, versus something like you're describing. I mean, I think it's good movement. I just think we're a ways from getting there yet.
Okay, we're down to our last two questions, and this one sort of mines all of your experiences and your travels and in your work. Do you have any sort of story that you can share, maybe something amusing, surprising, unexpected, or amazing?
Oh, yeah. Well, the one story I was thinking about this one is that we talked about, I mentioned a little bit ago, you know, SOA, right, and that how I always laughed when a vendor, service-oriented architecture, a vendor said, well, here it is in a box. Well, you know, Intel's experience with this, and I shared this with a very large telecommunications company in Japan. You know, it is a journey for us that has probably been going on now roughly 18 years, okay, through about five CIOs, you know, and it started at being able to build some kind of standards around the way we approach programming. You know the drill, right? And it's, you know, obviously what I was trying to convey to this company is that, yes, it can save money, okay, and yes, you can get there, but, you know, the reality is it isn't going to be next week. And the group that we were with, right, some spoke limited English, some didn't speak English at all, so we had to have one of our salespeople there translating. And I get to the presentation, and a big smile came on the face of the senior person at the table. And he said in Japanese, and I can't repeat it, but I can repeat the translation. He says, oh, I get it, right? Big plan, you know, little execute. Okay, and meaning that, you know, you gotta think big, act small, really, was what it translated to, right? And so, yeah, he said that, so in other words, what he got was, okay, it takes time, but, you know, you gotta execute in little, elements, right? And I said, absolutely, because that's how you get funding for next year. And so I've used that using I've got it written in Japanese regularly, right, when I go and talk with people. Think big, act small. And what I've also added to that, and move fast, okay, because all of that ensures you're going to get funding for next year. And of all the discussions I've had, that's the one that stands out where, you know how you're in a room and you can see the lights, the lights are going on in people's heads. Okay. And that was the one time that I really remember. And that was probably 5-6 years ago now. And I still use that phrase.
That's interesting. Sort of think big, execute in increments, but quickly. Right?
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, that's exactly the way you will work. It succeeds, right? And of course, you know, the other thing that's amazing is that it's been consistent through five CIOs for us, right? And, you know, generally every CIO comes in with an agenda, but this is one, well, SOA for us has been consistent from, you know, 15, 18 years ago to where we are today. And so that, again, but like I said, the thing that just I remember because the big smile and the lights kind of went on in the room. And that's, I still use it. So it very appropriately describes the process.
Well, we're down to our last question, and this is where I turn the tables, Bob, and you get to sort of ask yourself a question or a couple of questions I may have missed, and then you're going to provide your own answers.
Oh, bummer. I wasn't ready for this one. I found this very interesting because you absolutely made me think, you know, where do you see, you know, like I said, I think we've pretty much covered everything already, Stephen. I know that as I look forward, as we move forward, I think, as I said a bit ago, that, you know, where the IT profession is going and how it's going to be getting there and what's going to be happening to the profession are things that, you know, are foremost on my mind right now. I think that as I look forward, this is overused, but IT absolutely needs to demonstrate value to the business, you know. And everybody has given that a lot of lip service for 30 years, but I think that, you know, the time is now, because if you don't, then you're going to be outsourced. And again, maybe that's a little bit draconian, but everything right now seems to me to be leading to that conclusion. This goes back to, as I said earlier, the move back to line of business IT and the general disappearance or reduction in size of your central IT shop. How this plays out, I think that's going to be something very interesting to watch as we move forward. So with that's probably my last thoughts on this, Stephen. So does that make sense to you?
Yeah, this whole idea that you have to demonstrate value, I guess there's the ITCMF, right, the Capability Maturity Framework, which is
Yes.
this benchmark about all about value, or there's this concept called benefit realization, and it's all about value, or you see it in COVID-5, where they have an emphasis on value, or enterprise architecture, it's all about value as well, right? So.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, what's interesting about all of those models, because I've used, in fact, I've helped put together ITCMF, and you know, there's again, it's one of these groups that I'm on LinkedIn. Is that, you know, what's the value of a maturity assessment, right? It isn't the number, you know, that you get. And again, remember, all of this is based originally on SEI CMM, right? Which again, that's another life. But so great, you get a number, right? A number. Let's say you're rated a 2. So what, right? Where and how? What tells a company that they need to be a 3, right, or a 4? And once that's decided, how do you get there? Why? What's it going to cost you to get there versus what's it going to cost, you know, what is it going to cost you to get to that versus the benefit? And one of the things that I, again, remembering how long a career I've had, right, one of the original purposes of CMM, and I don't think we talked about this, right, we were getting buggy code and nuclear weapons, and I'm not making this up, right? And so this was, you were going to have a really bad day if you had bad code in a MIRV, okay? Basically a MIRV is an ICBM that has 10 warheads in it, right? And if it had bad code, you were going to have a really bad day. So the whole purpose of CMM, at least one of the main purposes, was a way to guarantee, at least on paper, the ability of a defense contractor, right, to crank out good code or solid code. And, you know, I left that life, and then 20 years later, I started seeing people who were advertising. They were CMM level 5 certified, right? This is for public companies. And it's like, boy, that's a dumb idea. Why would anybody want that level of assuredness, right? Because obviously there's a cost to achieving that level of quality, right? And so it kind of goes back to, that's why I asked the question, okay, great, you're a 2, why do you want to go to a 3, right? And then, you know, can you do it yourself, which most companies, you know, whether at ITCMF or CMMI, right, decide they're good enough to improve themselves, but then do you go back and retest, right? And so again, that could be a whole nother call. I've spent a lot of time in that side of things, and it's interesting you brought that up. Because like I said, it's not the maturity assessment. It's, okay, why do I want to get to the next level? Okay, what's it going to do for me?
Well, that just triggered another question in me, and that is, what are your top resources? Like, what are the things that you think would be useful to the audience to look up?
Oh, boy. That's a leading question. I mean, in terms of what, Stephen, can you put a little bit more context on that?
Well, there's so much noise on the Internet. And there's so much availability of information, and we get spammed I get spammed probably 1,000 times per day. I even get spammed in my social media profiles. I have just tons of invitations. I don't know what's good and what's bad. There's so much stuff out there. How do you sort the noise from the good stuff? I mean, what are your recommendations of things that you use? For example, for myself, I'm a member of the ACM. I love all of the material that they put out. I'm a member of KIPPS. I love the stuff they put out. These are professional associations, and you know they publish journals and things like that. So, those are the things that I would recommend. Or FIPO, you know, they're working on enterprise architecture kind of artifacts that I think will be of great value to people working in the EA space, and you know the list goes on. But you must have some of your favorites.
Yeah, generally I look at stuff coming from TOGAF, the open group, right? I look at stuff coming from Zachman. Believe it or not, only because, I say it believe it or not, Gartner, I mean, what I tell people about Gartner is that sometimes they may not be absolutely right, but what's amazing to me, and don't misunderstand what I just said, Gartner is a source of good information, right? And it's what normal people, business people look at before they look at anything technical, okay? So I often look at what Gartner provides if you have a Gartner subscription. I use some LinkedIn groups, are better than others. And, you know, IEEE, I get feeds from them. So again, you learn across, you know, it only takes about a month after you sign up to something or something new, whether it's going to be mostly advertising or garbage, right, versus something that you can use. And then you just start filtering out, you know, it goes to spam once you subscribe to it, right? It's no good. So those generally are the ones that I look at first, okay? It varies. I mean, the problem is, as you said, you get a million emails a day, you know, 99% of which are garbage that don't do any good, and then you've got to filter through your notes, just like you do. I mean, that's the only thing you can do, I think.
Bob, we've been on a journey with you. So I want to thank you for coming in today. I mean, you just shared so much of your experiences, and every time I ask a question, and you open up another sort of gate or a floodgate, like, for example, ITCMF. I didn't realize you worked on that.
That could be... helped. I mean, it came through Innovation Value Institute, right, and NUI Minute, and Intel was one of the founding members of that, along with Boston Consulting Group. So I helped build the EAM module for them. I helped build their cloud module. I just literally got back from Ireland last month, where we put together a cloud readiness assessment that the world hasn't seen yet, that's in kind of beta, but we were working with the Irish government on a cloud data center assessment. And I mean it's interesting. And I said what's fascinating about ITCMF is that it's probably the broadest. If you look at the competitors, right, COBIT, CMMI, and again, this is an advertisement. It's pretty comprehensive. And but it's still I call it the baby of the group, right? Because outside of Europe, generally, not too many people have even heard of it.
You know, it's interesting that you mention, you know, the cloud element, and I'm actually supporting some governments in their e-government programs.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and man, that's such a big question, is the cloud and just how to manage all of that in some way. And to put some sort of measures behind that, benchmarks, and how to assess gaps and so on. The fact that I can tell them now that you've worked on this thing, it may not be released yet, but to watch for it, right? So
yeah, well, we're looking. They're looking for, like I said, the Irish government was interested in the cloud data center readiness assessment, right? That we put together, and but it, you know, all governments are generally struggling with the same thing right now when it comes to cloud, right? And when I say all governments, whether they're national government or state or local, and yeah, no, I didn't realize you were in the ITCMF. That's the first I've heard about it too from you. So.
Well, the thing is that at the Economic Forum, I keynoted, and there were something like over 140 countries there.
Uh-huh.
And then a number of them came up, and they were asking for advice, and now I'm advising some governments. So, and Paris, in just a few weeks, I mean, there's going to be over probably 120 to 140 governments there as well, and the same thing in May and Geneva.
Oh, really?
And just hungry for this stuff. Yeah, lots of investment. They need guidance. They're just looking anywhere for guidance. So. It's good to know comes out of this interview, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, I've actually put together, it's interesting because I've presented to the Commonwealth of Virginia, a lot of governments, right? As you said, there's a lot of interest in this because you know, everybody, this would be better for an offline discussion. But, I didn't realize you were doing that.
Yeah, let's connect afterwards because I've got 140 countries looking at what you've got.
Okay. Not a problem.
About 10 minutes ago, that was my closing statement, right? Bob, thank you. You're so busy.
As I said, man, I have a lot of different interests.
Anyways, I'll try again. Bob, you've been amazing. You got this great background. You're this global leader. In fact, you were recommended by John Martin, right, because of just your tremendous leadership for so many years. So thank you for coming in today to do this interview, and we really appreciate your sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
Oh, Stephen, it's been my pleasure, man. We could go on for the next 2 hours, but I don't think we got the time. Hey, listen, thank you very much, and you have a great week.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Bob Deutsche, global top technology expert and executive.